Your favourite film is Awful.
Hello, and welcome to Your Favourite Film is Awful, the show where we take your favourite films and defend them against negative reviews. As always, I'm Luke, and with me, as always, it's Charlie. How you doing, Charlie?
I'm good, thanks, my man. I'm just sitting here on my little squeaky chair, which I'm sorry for fans if it was annoying last week. I'm trying my best to not move too much. But yeah, it's very squeaky, so heads up on that one.
It is. I think it's one of those that either you need to not move at all, or we're going to have to take your chair privileges, and you'll just have to record standing up.
I just have to stand.
Yeah.
Oh, my legs will give way because, you know, as it's been lockdown over here, I've barely walked like 500 steps, maybe. I don't know. I haven't looked, but I don't really want
to. What over the entire lockdown?
Well, because, yeah, today I realised I hadn't been out all week. And I was like, oh, I've got to go to the shops at least. So, I walked around the corner and walked back. Which literally, not long at all, literally walked to the shop around the corner.
It is one of those. We live in an age where everything can come to you. So why would you go out? Like, pandemic, mandemic, order in. Easy.
Yeah. But you're all good, Luke, on your side?
I'm very well, thank you. What have you been up to anything apart from your little walk? Have you watched anything of interest?
I'm glad you asked, Luke, because I watched a movie last night that I wish I could have watched with you, if I'm honest with you. It is 1977 Japanese horror movie called House. Have you heard of this?
I have not heard of this.
I was about to attempt to say the director's name, but I'm not going to do that because I don't want to.
Because you won't be able to say it. That's why.
Yes, I don't think I can. Well, I think it's Obayashi.
Obayashi.
I think so. Anyway, House, right?
House.
It is possibly the strangest movie I have ever seen. And I've seen some fucking weird movies, ladies and gentlemen.
I was about to say.
I've seen some weird fucking movies. I don't know if I could put this movie into words. Like, if anyone out there who's seen this knows what I'm talking about. It's essentially about, like, I think it's like six schoolgirls who go to this girl's aunt's house. Turns out the house is haunted. Simple story. But it's not necessarily the story. It's more how it's all done. And there's like floating heads. There is like one of the girls knows kung fu. And
of course.
She like it. Yeah, there's like a really cool bit where like, you know, like usually when the ghost or whatever starts chucking things at them in the house, she decides to like kick and punch them. I was like, why has no one ever tried that before? Yeah, I was like, hell yeah. The first half is like a fantasy, like romantic, not romantic, but like a fantasy sort of teen movie.
Okay.
But like to the point where I mean like it feels like a sitcom. Like, this guy, he, like, falls over onto a bucket, and then, like, a car comes past, and, like, he starts, like, swerving out of the way of the car, like, on this bucket, and, like, yeah, mate, it's the most tonally strange movie I've ever seen. There are, like, but I'm not gonna lie to you, I fucking loved it.
Yeah.
Like, there was something about it. There was so much, like, creativity. Like, there's no pretentiousness whatsoever. It's just completely weird shit happening. It just felt like a kid made it, but not in a, I don't mean that in a bad way, I mean in terms of like there's just so much craziness, like the house, like they get, there's a killer piano in it. I just it's one of those movies that I feel like you should just watch blindly as well, because I did that. I mean, I knew it was weird. I had an idea it was weird, but I didn't quite know how intense it was going to go. But the beauty of it is only like 80 minutes and it just flies by. And like, whether you hate it or not, like, you can't tell me that it's boring. Like, there's nothing about the movie that is boring. Like, everything about it is larger than life. There's actually some really cool camera tricks that are used in it. There's some really terrible, like, blue screen in it that you can clearly see where they've keyed out. Like, They've not even tried, but they have, because obviously this is 1977. This is the year that A New Hope come out. So, you know, it's and it's weird watching it with that context. Like, Star Wars come out this year, and this movie come out the same year, and it's absolutely bonkers, and I fucking loved every minute of it. And Luke, I really want you to watch it so badly, because I just want to see, I'd just love to see your reaction to it. Like, yeah. but yeah. I could go on all day. I could just do a whole podcast about this, which I hope one day we will do.
One day.
Because it would
day.
Be amazing. Yeah, but yeah. How about yourself, Luke? Have you watched anything as strange as House or done anything interesting?
Nothing as strange as that. I've been rewatching a lot of stuff this week, kind of introducing my family to bits and pieces. I introduced them to the Amazon Prime The Boys. Which, of course,
we spoke
last year about quite highly. Well, no, 2 years ago now. Gosh. But yeah, we spoke in the last season about quite highly. It's quite funny because, of course, it has moments where it dips and it's like character. So you can get to know the characters. So it like slowdowns and then it like hits those action beats. So it's quite funny, like, because my mom reads the paper during the day. And like on a tablet, and so she'd be like da 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 da, I'm just seeing like what happens to translucent happens, and she's like la da da da, oh god, what the fuck, which has been quite fun. And then I rewatched Marvel's The Avengers, the first one, and that was a nice little bit, a nice little film. It was very well made and such. And then
how was watching that?
It's so much lighter. Now that we've had the more recent stuff, like, I don't know, because it's because it's got this big job of being the first big team up thing, it focuses quite a lot on that aspect, and so there's not really much in the way of like development, because they don't have time to do that. It's just kind of throw these people together and get them out.
Okay.
And so it works. It's very efficient, but it's also quite, I guess, plain. It's like to go back to what Matt said the other day, it's like a burger, but without any of the toppings.
I see.
Yeah, it does it.
Because I haven't seen it in a couple of years now. And I remember rewatching it and thinking, I don't remember it feeling as like camp as this. Almost.
Oh, it
do you
is
I mean?
So camp.
Yeah, it's so camp, isn't it? But yeah, it's interesting to see, obviously, like at the time that blew our bloody minds away, like, to see all of those characters and, it, you know, seeing what we've got now in comparison. I mean, I still enjoy that movie a lot, and it still has its place. And obviously, for what it did at the time, was such a big deal.
Oh, definitely.
But it's interesting to see, like, some of it, I don't know if you feel like this, but some of it feels quite TV in terms of the way it's shot.
Yes. Yeah. However, like some of the, going off the same, the shots, there are some really good long takes. Which do, like, because it was renowned for that whole comic book feel. Like, when they do the spiral around the people, which is famous. But then there's another
all of
one
that is fantastic.
Oh, definitely. But then there's another one which, it starts with Scarlet Witch getting hold of a alien vehicle. And then it's just this long shot of all the different characters fighting. And finishes with Thor and Hulk taking down the big alien wormy tank, and it's just
did you say Scarlet
shot.
Witch did you mean Black Widow? No,
Black Widow, Scarlet Sorry. Hair, you know,
for a second I was like, are we talking about the same movie?
That
bit's really cool. I know what shot you're talking about, like that. I think the last, you know, sort of 10 minutes of that movie, that whole action stuff is like the best stuff in the movie. I thought it was some of the best stuff, like that blew us away that could be possible, like that whole action sequence, like to see Hulk and Thor, like who'd have thought, like back then. Obviously now we've seen Endgame.
Yeah, exactly.
back
we've
then,
seen a lot
you know,
more.
It was exactly.
It's crazy, really good. Yeah. And then of course at the end of the film, you have that lovely heroes pose where they all pose in front of Loki for no reason.
Oh yeah. Yeah, of course.
It's purely for us as fans in the cinema. And then the last thing, I've recently started rewatching Avatar The Last Airbender, which I know I've spoken to you about. Have you even watched a single episode of it yet?
I have. I watched two episodes, I think. and I did enjoy it.
Yeah.
I did enjoy it. It was one of those things where I just need to. I have too many shows on at the go, at the moment, and I need to just finish a couple of them, and then I can go back on. Do you know what I mean? Like one of those ones.
I mean, in fairness, that's kind of a fool's errand because nothing ever finishes these days. If it's a success, they're going to keep making it.
Yeah. And fun fact, you mentioned that because I know that, you know, we're releasing this podcast, you know, we're recording this a little bit earlier than when we release it. But this weekend, there is a UFC fighter fighting who calls himself the last Starbender.
Nice.
The Last Starbender. That's what he's called. Starbender. And he's great. He's like one of my favorite fighters. He's brilliant. But yeah, already right now, by this point, it's being released, people know if he won or not. So, but anyway, I don't know.
Magic.
Just want to bring that up. Don't know why.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Let's get to the matter at hand.
Okay, cool.
The fan submitted film suggestions for what we do here, because it's just the two of us. So this submission was from Greta, and that is Seven or Seven N.
Fantastic.
Can you tell us what Seven is about?
Seven is about two detectives called Somerset and Mills who are trying to catch a serial killer who is killing lots of people by using the seven deadly sins as his sort of like a, what would you say, code or...
just in the mark, style of...
Trademark, I guess.
It's a trademark.
Yeah.
Murder,
I guess.
TM.
Yeah.
No, fair. Yeah. No, it's one of those. It is a pretty basic premise at the end of the day. It's just the way that they do that premise is interesting and enjoyable to a few people.
I mean, you say trademark, you put the trademark on. Well, in David Fincher's Mindhunter, which, you know, we're going to go talk about David Fincher later on, in his Mindhunter, you actually see that a lot of the actual real serial killers, they actually do get kind of annoyed with other serial killers if they, like, copy their trends or something.
Oh, yeah, copycat killers.
They're weird. Yeah, they're weird dudes, obviously.
Obviously, otherwise they wouldn't be serial killers.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in fairness, though, we said that some people enjoy it. Some people don't. And one of those people is Tradwife, who gives it a half star. And their review goes as follows. A guy who models his killings after the seven deadly sins would work better as a James Bond villain. Not even that. A Scooby-Doo villain. It's so cheesy and silly. That line about how Aquinas was a guy who wrote about sin is exactly the kind of dialogue they'd give Velma to make her sound smart to kids. If this guy just spooked people instead of killing them, it would make such a great Scooby-Doo episode. When presented as a quasi-philosophical thriller, however, this is just dumb.
First of all, don't insult Scooby-Doo. Scooby-Doo's fantastic. Second of all, I think that's really, really scathing to compare it to like Scooby-Doo and say like that's kind of what it feels like. Because I think if you're watching this and you're thinking that... If you're watching Seven and you think this is like Scooby-Doo, then I need to watch the Scooby-Doo episodes that you're watching because they sound fantastic.
The R-rated Scooby-Doo.
I mean... Yeah, how could you say, like, this is, like, one of the darkest films I think I've ever seen. And that comes in a tastefully dark movie, you know? It's not a movie that particularly goes out of its way to show you, like, loads of gratuitous violence, necessarily. Like, you think about it. Like, you know, think about it. Like, you don't see any of the gruesome kills. Like, all the violence is off screen. You just see the dead bodies, really.
Well, yeah, but the it's quite grotesque imagery, even if it's not the killing itself.
Yes, but that's the magic of the image, though, isn't it? Like, the imagery itself is, and that's the magic of David Fincher, is that the imagery itself is horrifying, or the thought itself is horrifying. Like, you know, the guy in the sex shop, who works in the sex shop, and you know the way that happens with the fucking blade dildo thing.
That is
like one of the most disturbing, like, because and even that it's not, you don't, and you know, other directors out there would have probably, like, I don't know Gaspar Noir or someone would have probably shown that scene. Whereas, like, you know, you don't need to see that scene because the imagery that you create in your mind from seeing that guy's face and seeing how disturbed he is, like, is enough to for you to, like, it just makes you curl up inside, doesn't it? Like, that scene for me just is absolutely horrific. And I just think, like, to say it's like Scooby-Doo, like, Scooby-Doo every week is, you know, you kind of get an idea who the killer is. I mean, I feel like this movie doesn't do that at all. Like, the whole point is that, you know, they're looking for the killer, They're nowhere close to getting the killer. And then the killer turns up. And, you know, I think that was genius. Genius, like, structure to write a screenplay kind of mirrors things like, you know, it plays with you. It subverts your expectations as a viewer. And particularly for back then in 1995, in a way that something like Psycho would did at the time. Because, you know, you're not expecting the killer to turn up halfway through. And when he does, it's genius because you're now, as an audience, you're like, hold on a minute. We've got like 40 minutes left of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, what's going to happen? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, as a first-time viewer, you'd be like, okay, so what the fuck happens now? Because most murder mystery thrillers, it's the chase.
And I think that is like some of the most rewarding, best feeling a movie can sort of give you sometimes. Like, when, particularly if you're someone that watches a lot of movies, you know, you pick up the tropes, you get used to the same sort of beats and plots in movies. So when a film comes along and makes you go, hold on a minute, I don't know where this is going, there's a really exciting feeling that comes with that. And I think even the common, you know, audience goer, like film watcher, is gonna, you know, feel that dread. Like, and it's just the way the film's structured. Like, I don't know about you, Luke, like, but I personally, whenever that happens, even though I know it's happening, there's particularly the first time, it's like, what's gonna happen now? And you don't like it because so far this guy has gotten away with it with so much, and you're thinking in the back of your mind, there's, you know, this can't go right for these two detectives, can it? And you don't want to see anything happen to these guys either. Like, you've built up such a great, you know, the classic buddy cop of, you know, they don't really get along. You know, you've got the old guy who's about to retire. You know, it keeps the tropes of the genre. You know, you've got the old guy's going to retire, the young guy who's coming in, he's a bit brash and cocky. And throughout the movie, you know, that kind of, you know, his cockiness definitely goes away through the actions of the killer and what he does. But yeah, I think that's a very scathing review. I think, you know, regardless if you don't like this movie, I think you can still respect the craft of it.
I mean, maybe they didn't mean any disrespect. I mean, have you seen some of those Scooby-Doo episodes? Like, some of the old Scooby-Doo episodes, they were just throwing people out buildings and stuff. You just hoped that they got caught. I try so hard to say that with a straight face. Just, oh, but Scooby-Doo, in fairness, Scooby-Doo when you're younger is pretty scary, and this when you're slightly older is pretty scary. So, like, I can see the comparison. Also, come on, who doesn't want to actually see that now? Like, some Scooby-Doo writer.
David Fincher's Scooby-Doo, yes.
Whoa, I don't know about David Fincher's Scooby-Doo. Just the Seven Deadly Sins Scooby-Doo. Oh, mine, but Scooby-Doo's been around Scooby-Doo long enough that they probably have done it. They just snuck it into loads of different episodes.
Oh, yeah. Probably.
Would you like a slightly longer review?
Yeah, go on. Give me something a bit juicy, a bit meaty. Something that can give me some good points. Go on.
Okay. Well, this one is from Janet Maslin. It is from 1995.
Okay, so it's from the year it came out.
It is from the times. Although the director, David Fincher, and the screenwriter, Andrew Kevin Walker, borrow so many familiar elements for their story, they seem determined to give it an uncommonly nasty spin. So the crime scenes are rendered in sickening detail, and the whole film has a murky, madly pretentious tone. Visually, the effect is that of spending a long time looking at a bowl of oatmeal on a rainy day. Only during its last scenes does the film brighten, partly because of the actor who is revealed as the killer, and partly because the action finally moves outdoors in broad daylight. That's paragraph one.
Very. Can I cut in there? Yes. That's really interesting so far, because, you know, this is a, you know, this is 1995, so we've just come off the 80s, which is an era where everything pretty much had a happy ending, with the exception of the horror movies that come out. Everything was a, you know, happy ending, and it was a very optimistic era for sort of films that were coming out, and people, some people put the 80s in a category of like one of the worst decades because of that, because it kind of stuck to a lot of action movie tropes and was very optimistic and didn't, you know, push too many dark ideas sort of thing.
Well, yeah, wasn't,
and then you cut to the 90s and this is kind of,
wasn't the 80s the like golden age? It was like that whole, the heroes are heroes, the villains are villains. It's very black and white and a bit campy.
Yes, definitely. And you get your Arnold movies, you know, your Stallones, you know, all these guys are coming out. But yeah, and then you get to the 90s and it's like reactionary. Like you always kind of see in life, you know, you get this flip side, which is now you've got the 90s where these independent filmmakers are coming out and they're trying to subvert the tropes of the films that are coming out in the 80s. This is one of those movies. It's really weird that they're kind of using the weather. Again, I mean, you know, going back to that 80s thing, is it coming back from an era of, you know, everything was sunny and happy and, you know, optimistic? It's interesting that this reviewer saw this movie as pretentious because of its dark themes and tones, which is not something I would consider it to be.
I mean, it is very dark, murky, rainy. Like,
yes,
you could easily set this in like in Batman's Gotham and no one would bat an eyelid because it rains all the time. Why does it rain?
It does feel like that, doesn't it? Exactly, but like, you know, it's a cliche to say this, but it's like, you know, it's like a character in the movie. The city, you know, the city itself is like a character in the film.
It is.
You know, but, you know, that's Fincher using all the tools that he has to tell the story.
And it's a character that doesn't even deserve a name, because they don't name the city. It's just...
They don't name the city.
City.
Just dark, fucked up city that no one wants to go to.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's something
horrible
like
city.
Yeah, and, you know, from the start, you spend a little bit of time with Somerset. And there's no dialogue, pretty much. It's just him in his house. And you see, you know, you see that he's a detective. You see he's a very organized man. By the way, he keeps his equipment next to each other by his gun. And, you know, I mean, you could break down the opening scene alone forever. Like, you know, that I had to do in sixth form when I was younger. So I'm not going to do that because I was sick of it by that point. But it's funny,
contrast,
all the movies I did study...
Mm-hmm.
Of all the movies I did study at sixth form, this is the only one that I've pretty much still kept rewatching. Like, I didn't, even though I've like rinsed it, I see it so many times, I can't get enough of this film. So I'm going to be very biased with these reviews, Luke, because this is like one of my favorite movies of all time. and I actually think it's one of my favorite, it's probably my favorite David Fincher movie as well. So yeah, so I'm going to be... So you're gonna have to balance me out a bit, Luke, with this, because I will go off on tangents.
Well, like, even now I can say I don't think it's my favourite Fincher, so there we go, already we're balancing off. what I was going to say, though, what you just said about the analysis of Somerset definitely contrasts that of Mills, and the fact that Somerset has this very organised, very well-maintained apartment, and then Mills... has this new apartment where he keeps several large dogs in one room.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
And he's just fine with it.
That is a noisy house, isn't it? Like, you've got the train going past, you've got the three dogs.
Oh, yeah. Not to mention that... So that those trains, I think they said, like, when they were viewing the house, they only got to see it in 15-minute... intervals, and then it was like, cool, let's leave because a train's on its way. So let's say optimistically 20 minutes every a train comes. That means those dogs be barking every 20 minutes.
Every 20 minutes
after the train has come. Probably bark for
5 minutes. I would have saved John Doe the job, I think. Saved John Doe the job. Just blow my own brains up.
Shall we? Let's continue.
Yeah, continue with the
report. Mr. Freeman moves sagely through Seven with the air of one who has seen it all and will surely be seeing something better very soon. His performance has just the kind of polish and self-possession that his co-star, Mr. Pitt, seems determined to avoid, demonstrating an eighth sin by frittering away an enormously promising career. Mr. Pitt walks through this film looking rumpled and nonchalant, mumbling his lines with hip diffidence to spare. He remains too detached to show much enthusiasm, except for times when the screenplay begins moralizing about what a sick world we live in. Films like this one, and say, California, aren't making it any better.
Interesting. I think that critique of Brad Pitt's performance is strange, because I think that's kind of the point. Like she said, he kind of walks around the movie and, you know, doesn't with not much care. I mean, that's the character, isn't it? The character, he walks around and he thinks he knows it all and kind of has this cocky, confident nature that, you know, he's going to figure things out. And I guess, you know, the movie eventually shows him here in the most horrible way possible that he doesn't.
But he has the air of, you know, I mean? Like he's big fish in a little pond, so they've moved the fish to a bigger pond. And he still has that mentality of, I'm a big fish. But now there are sharks.
Exactly. Like, he's in a town full of, like, horrible stuff now. This is a horrible town. This is not like where you did your training. Do you know what I mean? Sort of thing. And it's, you can see from the way he carries himself that, you know, how Somerset, I mean, Morgan Freeman's fantastic in this movie, just to, I think it's important to speak about the fact that, you know, he just come off of like Shawshank and I think like Driving Miss Daisy. Like he had a few, like this was like his sort of golden period for a time where a lot of people were talking about Morgan Freeman, and I think this is like one of his best performances. But I think it, like you said there, it kind of contradicts, not contradicts, but like Morgan Freeman, whenever something horrific happens, he's still collected, you know, he's still calm, you know, because he's seen it a million times. Whereas Brad Pitt's character is, he's reactionary immediately, isn't he? Like he's getting aggressive, like he wants to kick the door down and do things. And he's like, because Somerset's kind of, obviously not this case before, but he's been here before, you know, he's dealt with these kind of, well, that's how his mannerisms come across. Whereas Brad Pitt's character Mills feels like, you know, he's not used to this. So he's getting a bit more emotionally invested than he needs to. Mm. And, you know, I'm saying all this, but none of this is, you know, is in the scripts and stuff. This is all from the filmmaking, from the product, you know, from his performance, from Fincher's direction, from the clothing he's wearing, from the way he's carrying himself, all of this. And that's all the recipes for a great movie to me. So it's interesting. I found that review, quite difficult to argue with, in a sense, because it seems that all the problems they have with it, in my opinion, kind of felt like, you know, that was intentional. It's just that obviously they didn't like that. And, you know, I guess I know they're trying to point out, you know, it's just dark for dark's sake, but I don't necessarily feel that. I think it's a well-constructed movie.
But then what you were saying before with the, so this was, this is a review from 1995. So they're living this change from a horror film being a horror film, an action film being an action film, into this more murky waters of a action film with thriller elements, thriller with horror elements, and that sort of like twisting the stereotypes into a more darker bit, which happened throughout the 90s into the 2000s. So they're living it, and if it isn't a change that they're enjoying, then they're gonna lash out and be like, but it's pretentious, it's murky, it's like staring into a bowl of rainy, watery oatmeal.
Yeah. I don't know. It's fascinating that obviously seeing this review because of that context, it's interesting to see what people thought then. Whereas I feel like, you know, now people are like, what do you mean? We've seen dark stuff loads of times. We've seen loads of movies and shows. And isn't there like a show now that loads of, like my little sister I think watches, it's called like You, and it's like you follow a serial killer. around or something. I don't know. I haven't seen it. But you know what I mean? Like, people are more, we're more used to this sort of stuff now. And if anything, like, serial killer documentaries are, like, bigger than ever now, aren't there? There's always some sort of serial killer documentary on Netflix and stuff. And it's funny because, like, when people say to me, like, oh, I love, like, serial killer documentaries, like, what movies do you recommend me, sort of thing, I'm always like, have you seen Seven? Because, like, to me, that's, like, yeah, that's the...
Well, yeah,
best,
but then there's the difference of genre and movie. Like, a lot of people that enjoy serial killer documentaries and stuff can't watch horror movies because they can consume that sort of gore post-action. So, like, it's happened already. It's you're only going to see, like, images of, like, the aftermath and recreations, whilst a horror is like, here's some guts, here's some gore, here's some blood, here's a dirty, nasty room with a fat man that ate himself to death.
Yeah. Here's another room. Would you class this as a horror, then?
I'd say that this was a thriller with horror elements. I'd say, like, the rooms themselves are quite horrific to look upon, especially the gluttony room, the sloth room, and the lust room. I'd say those three. So fat man, man who's been barely kept alive, and the knife dildo.
That scene is so disturbing. That scene with the guy who's like kept there and starved is absolutely horrific. Do you know what's like funny about that scene actually?
Go on then.
You know when he wakes up?
Yes. Yeah, and the guy shits himself.
Yeah, everyone on set didn't know he was going to do that. Like, it wasn't planned. So he just did it. So the reaction you see in the movie is actually their reaction to him going, like, oh, I'm not making a noise. Like, that's actually their reaction, which is brilliant.
Oh, that's brilliant.
That's great. Yeah, and also, I think this is quite a common thing, but just to go for another fact, Brad Pitt, he like cut his arm through, like, when he was like, do you remember the chase scene when he's chasing after John Doe?
Yes.
He cuts his hand on the, he caught it on like one of the wind screens of a car or something. I don't know, on wind mirrors or something. He had to wear like a cast for like the rest of the movie. But like, in some of the scenes, he doesn't have it on. And if you look properly, his hand's like swollen and purple. We have to like really look, and like a lot of the time he has his hands in his pockets and stuff because like that was their way of like trying to get around it. Just to go for another fact, in the final scenes with, do you know when Mills and Somerset, you know, and they're in the wasteland sort of bit.
Yes.
You know talking about when?
Yeah, in the desert.
In the desert, sort of thing, and he's like, "What's in the box?" and all that stuff. Well, in some of the shots, and even the mid shots, it isn't Kevin Spacey. It's actually his stunt double. And it's actually crazy because you can't really tell. Like, that's how much they must have looked like each other. I just thought that was another like fascinating thing. Like, and when someone pointed it out, like I watched a video that sort of pointed it out, I was like, oh, damn. Like, you can actually tell, but it's the confidence in the filmmaker to do that, I think.
Well, do you think that was... that ties into the fact that he's not on the... Like, they kept the killer's identity secret to the point where he's not even acknowledged on like the posters or any of the promo material. He's not there because they wanted nobody to know who the killer was. So do you think that's why they got the stunt double in? So anybody taking set pictures wouldn't catch Kevin Spacey acting and so wouldn't know he was the killer and leak it to the press.
That's a really interesting point that you brought up, and it made me I actually know the reason, and the reason is that Kevin Spacey had to do another film. but it's interesting that you brought that up, because you know in that day and age people didn't really, that wasn't really a thing as much.
Like, oh no,
didn't really care about people going on set and taking pictures because it wasn't as much of a big deal, particularly for movies like Seven. It might have been the case with, like, I don't know, Star Wars, for example, and, like, Phantom Menace is very different. But, you know, for Seven, this crime movie by the guy who made Alien 3, I don't think anyone's really... You know, this is... And also, this is, like, kind of pre... This is, like, before social media, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, these things weren't... It's funny because I think it's interesting you said that because obviously like we're so used to that now, that culture of you've got to hide things and stuff. Yeah.
But it also ties in because I don't know if you've seen it, but there's a film called Phone Booth.
The Joel Schumacher one with Colin Farrell. Exactly. I haven't actually seen it though. I've always wanted to.
Ah. Okay, well, on the poster for that film, you have Colin, you've got I think one of the police detectives, but you've also got this other man whose name I forget. But like he was a well-known actor, he still is a well-known actor, and because he isn't in any of the trailers apart from like one shot of him turning and walking away, everyone looked at the poster, looked at the trailer, and went, "Cool, so that's the killer because there's a notable name and you've put it on the poster, so I'll watch the film."
Exactly, yeah, that's funny. Yeah.
Let's finish off this review and then we can move on. Seven is also notable for an excessive runtime and a lot of shrill or rumbling sound effects that deliver more jolts than the action can. Not even bags of body parts, a bitten off tongue, or a man forced to cut off a pound of his own flesh, think The Merchant of Venice, keep it from being dull. End of extract.
I mean, this movie is far from dull, and I think it completely justifies its time limit. To me, there's never really a point where I'm checking my watch. Particularly the first time.
Not even when he's in the library? Not even when they're doing this other scene, which could have been slimmed or trimmed.
No, but that's him. That's the only kind of only moment you have with sort of Somerset where he's kind of happy. Do you know what I mean? It's the only time where you actually see him like in his element a little bit. So I think it's quite an important scene because it's like, oh, now we get why this guy does it, because he kind of loves it. Even though it's all, you know what I mean? Like he's kind of getting a little bit excited, and it's the closest we get to seeing him show an emotion other than sadness, really. I don't think so. I feel like I never noticed I think the pacing's phenomenal. This movie, I think it flies by. It's opinion. It's opinion based. It's my opinion versus this reviewer's opinion, but I would completely disagree with that. It's just weird to hear them talk about Brad Pitt's character, walking through the film, and Morgan Freeman's. They didn't really say anything about Morgan Freeman, so they must have obviously.
No, they said Morgan Freeman was like, mwah, brilliant. I don't know, brilliant.
Sometimes it's hard to remember all the review.
Yeah, I think. They said that I think Morgan Freeman has an air about him that's very polished and it's very well executed, whilst Mr. Pitt is determined to not be polished and is not delivering the goods. And in fact, I think they say that he's throwing his career away.
That's so insane, because this is like one of his like most unknown performances. So weird to hear that. I mean, now everyone knows the Brad Pitt, what's in the box? Like, everyone knows that, even if you haven't seen the movie. Pretty much most people have heard that saying before.
Demonstrating an eighth sin by frittering away an enormously promising career.
That's so crazy. And boy, was this reviewer wrong, because Brad Pitt is still relevant today and still smashing it.
Has he done anything this dark since?
I'd have to really have a flick through. I'm trying to think off the top of my head.
Because like I have,
cynical, but this is like one of the most cynical movies. Though, like, do you know what I mean, in terms of it's very dark and grim. I mean, just from the title sequence alone is like one of the most disturbing serial killer just horror things I've seen. It's actually like one of my favorite title sequences, not just because it has a Nine Inch Nails song over it, but also because. because you know the books that you see in the title sequence,
yes,
and all the books that you see in the apartment of John Doe.
Mm-hmm.
Every single one of those books is full to the brim with writings that they believe John Doe would have said. So the production designers actually filled out all those books in the handwriting that you see. For the authenticity of it.
For those just listening, I am shaking my head very slowly. That's the, like, sometimes that type of like detail and craft is mwah. But why? Why do that to those poor people? Like those set designers and stuff. Why would you do that? That's so harsh. That's awful.
I think it was actually, I don't think that it was forced to do it. I think they actually, I think they chose to finish it all. I don't know if it was something that Fincher, I don't know what the thing was with that. I've got a feeling it was the production, but you don't know because Fincher's obviously a very...
Fincher's like notorious for cracking the whip, isn't he?
He's notorious for doing multiple takes more than anything. Which so I never used to understand until I've seen a few more interviews with him sort of talking about it or other actors explaining it. And, you know, they sort of said that, I mean, the best person who explained it was Mark Ruffalo when he was filming Zodiac, because he said that he was filming the scene and they did it over like 100 takes or something, right? And he said they're on like take 50 or something. And I'm sitting here, like obviously it's David Fincher, and I'm thinking like, what am I doing wrong? I'm doing my best here. Like, what am I doing wrong? Like, what's going on? And he said Fincher comes walking over to me, and I think like, oh no, he's going to have a go at me, like, because I've done 50 takes of the same scene over and over again. Oh no, what's going to happen? And he said that Fincher walked over to me, he patted me on the back and walked straight past me and moved like an extra in the background, like an inch, and went, yeah, let's go again. and that's when I realised that like, it's not about the necessarily just the acting for Fincher. It's about every single thing in the frame. Yeah. Like, and I do understand that, because I think a lot of the times you think, oh, we get the performance, it's fine. But it's not just the actor that's got to deliver. It's the lighting guy. It's the camera guy. It's the sound guy. Like, all these things. It's the extras. All these things need to come into play to get the perfect shot. And, you know, Fincher's such a perfectionist. And... you know, it shows, you know, that shows in his work. You know, it shows because there's so much detail in every single frame of his movies, because, you know, he puts that time in. So, yeah, so I think it's one of those things that's kind of misunderstood by people. I think people see it as like, oh, it's about the actor, but I don't think it is. It's about the whole thing. But then it's funny, because I think, I can't remember what director it was. It might be like Terry Gilliam or someone like that said, if you have to do over... like five takes or something, you're a shit director or some shit. I think it was Ridley Scott. That was it. Yeah. And I was just like, it's just funny seeing the difference, isn't it?
Difference and like and it, making it work.
Yeah. And it's like, well, obviously it works for Ridley Scott, because, you know, Ridley Scott made Alien and Blade Runner and Gladiator. And obviously it works. This style works for Fincher, because he made, you know, everything. All of his fucking movies are great. Pretty much. Yeah. So I think that's, it's an interesting just the thing to talk about.
I mean, from an acting perspective, there is an argument to be made that, so say the actor needs to go on stage, takes his jacket off, throws it on the chair, and then goes to sit on a different chair. On the first take, that is an actor doing the actions. On the 10th take, that is the person putting his coat on his chair to relax in his other chair. So, it, like, I can understand it from that perspective of, like, an acty thing.
Yes, definitely.
But also, it, like, to go off what you said, actors don't show up on set and do the stuff the first time in movies. They've had so many, like, months of going through it and, like, pre-rehearsal and pre-production.
Rehearsal,
and yeah. So it's exactly as you said. It's very rarely that it's the actor's fault to call cut and to go again. It is, as you said, it's the lighting, it's getting everything just right, just perfect, which in some cases they're like, nah, that's what I wanted, well done, this was one take wonder. And other times it's Fincher being like, actually, there's a speck of dust on his glasses, go again.
But yeah, that gets the results, I guess, for Fincher. So whatever, that everyone's process is different. I tried to talk about the ending, because a lot of people, and it's a big thing, I've done this test myself, a lot of people think that you actually see Gwyneth Paltrow's head inside the box when you don't see her head inside the box. And it's a big argument that people have sometimes. Yeah, like some people, and it's a big thing. Like, and I've asked loads of people and they've gone, no, you definitely see her head in the box. I'm like, you don't. You don't see it. No. You see her
I think there's
face,
like a blood streak on the
box
itself.
You see her face flash. You see her face flash up, but it's like just a shot of her face. It's not like, it's just a shot of Gwyneth Paltrow's face. And yeah, I just think that's so clever of the filmmakers. Like, you know, like I said, any other filmmaker could have showed that head, but like, you don't need to. Like, again, the thought of it is worse. You're seeing it through you can't possibly see it through the eyes of Mills. But if you don't show it, you can. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can feel how he feels by just holding that shot on him, like, as he breaks down. And that's why I think Pitt's great in it, because I think that scene totally relies on his performance. And it gets me every time. It's horrible. But what I wanted to talk about, to go off of that, was that there is an alternate ending that Fincher and Brad Pitt actually wanted that is not the ending that you see in the movie. So originally what they wanted was, they wanted after that whole scene with what's in the box, blah, blah, blah. You know, you have that like scene afterwards where Mills is in the car and Somerset says something along the lines of, he said something like, the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part. And that's the kind of like final line of the movie. Yeah. And the studio wanted that to be in because it's like a little bit more optimistic. Which is weird, because I don't find that end scene optimistic at all, because like, just seeing Mills sitting there like in the car, like not knowing what to do with himself, like, is just ugh. Like, yeah, what do you do? How do you continue your life after that event? And you know, obviously Somerset making the decision of like, yeah, I think I might have to stick around or whatever. Originally it was supposed to cut after the what's in the box scene, so you weren't gonna have that scene, so it was just gonna cut to black. After you found out all that stuff, it was just going to cut to black. After Mills shoots John Doe, it was just going to cut to black and leave it. But apparently what happened was, they did a test screening, I believe, and it cut to black, but the lights came on straight away when it cut to black. The test audience didn't like it, obviously, but like, they were annoyed because they were like, well, you need to sit in the dark for a bit, don't you? Do you know what I mean? You need to... before the lights like can come on. But yeah, they didn't. And then the studio sort of said, yeah, we want you to do this, like another scene on top. But it's interesting because I actually like the scene at the end. I think it's interesting, though, that the ending of it, you know, cut into black. But I think it is nice to have that bit of like seeing him, like just seeing how things have just completely changed and like...
Well, I thought you were going to talk about the original, what's it called when they do the shot list? Not shot list. When they like do the little drawings.
Storyboard.
Storyboard. The original storyboard ending, because that's different as well. Three different endings, because in that version, Somerset kills John Doe, so Mills can still replace him and become the new detective.
Yeah,
and I guess Mills can either go to jail or just retire. Depending on how that judgment goes.
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's also like, it's not giving John Doe what he wants per se, is it? Because he wants him to shoot. Because it's Ralph, isn't it? It's the last one.
Well, yeah, that's the whole point. It's so that...
Yeah.
Because if Mills kills John Doe wins, because then he's got all seven of his sins. Even though that doesn't make sense, because it's seven killings... for seven sins, but one of the last two sins is, I killed somebody else, therefore I'm envy, and you killed somebody else, therefore you're wrath. But the other five is, you died because you're this sin.
He cannot sacrifice himself. He's trying to make a point, isn't he? I mean, it's all whole shit anyway, isn't he? He's the serial killer, isn't he? Let's be honest.
It's trying to make method out of madness.
I just wanted to ask more on the subject. Well, first of all, do you have a favourite of those endings? Do you prefer the original? Do you prefer any of the alternate ones? Or,
I'd say the original. I mean, I'd say the original or the cut to black work. I feel this is one of those films where the baddie needs to win, because the world depicted in that film is a negative world. So the film needs a negative outcome.
Yeah.
So I feel like having that extra, like with the extra scene, the ending we get It's still a negative outcome because we don't know what's going to happen to Somerset. But that is that, like, air of hope. Nope. Mills goes to jail, potentially. Somerset has his line of hope. So that one works because we have watched this character, this new guy, come in and have his world destroyed. So that works. And then the cut to black also works because it is that air of mystery. It's we don't know what's going to happen afterwards. I think it was the right call to not have Somerset do the kill because, like, it's not been about Somerset, really. It's Mills's fall of grace, not Somerset's. If you get me?
Yeah, I get you.
What do you think? Yeah.
No, I would agree with that. I think I prefer the ending that they have already. I do like the idea of the cut to black, though. I think that's interesting. But I just like having... Yeah, I'm not too much of a fan of the Somerset one, just because I think, for me, you know, I've just known that's the ending, and I love that as, like, the ending. He just gets completely tortured, and then he still wins, like, in a very kind of Joker Batman way, doesn't he? In terms of, like, you know, there's nothing you can do. I've won no matter what, sort of thing.
Weird, because that's like a Joker's ultimate victory, isn't it? It's exactly, one of those that they keep playing the game, but if Batman actually kills the Joker, then he'll go off the rails.
Exactly.
Because he doesn't have that one rule anymore.
No, exactly. So I would say the original ending, I think, is my favourite. But I'm intrigued by the cut to black. I might almost just do it. I might just, like, cut it to black and just see... Just see how I feel about it.
Just the gunshot, pause film, walk away.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that sort of thing. That reminds me of, have you seen... This is going off tangent, but I don't care. Have you seen the edited version of Toy Story 3? Where somebody stopped the film when they're in the...
Oh, when they're falling down.
Yeah, when they're going down.
Thing, yeah.
They just, like, holding hands, ended the film. And then they showed that to their parents, being like, this is the new film. And so, like, it hits credits and the parents just sobbing because that's just such a way to end a film after three films with toys.
Funny. That would be insane. I remember a lot of people saying, yeah, it should have ended there. And I was like, see, if it ended there, I don't think I would have cried. But I did cry at the actual ending of Toy Story 3. it always gets to me. I think I spoke about it before. Yeah, the ending of Toy Story 3... I don't know why. Maybe because I'm like a little sad boy who does, you know, who understands what it's like to say goodbye to your childhood, even though I'm still doing a podcast where I talk about, I guess, childhood stuff, films and stuff. Yeah,
we've spoken before for quite a while.
Have we? Okay.
Yeah, I was just going to say
if you have a favorite scene at all, like, what was your favorite scene in the movie? Do you want me to say mine while you're thinking?
Yeah, say yours.
Yeah. So mine, I'm torn between two. I love that scene with the, you know, when they go into the guy who's, like, been, what sin is that again? The guy's laying on the bed and he's, like, been drinking.
Sloth.
That whole scene, I think, is horrific. And the whole chase before that, when he chases John Doe, Mills chases John Doe. I love all of that. But I think my favourite scene is probably the whole end in the car on the way to the... when, like, Mills and John Doe and Somerset are talking to each other in the car and you get to sit because you're like, you don't know what's happening. You don't know what's going on. They're driving. What the fuck's going on? And they really draw it out. Like, he pulls that rubber band, you know, he keeps pulling it and, like, you're like, oh, I don't know what's going to happen. I don't like what's going on. And it pays off. You know, it's very rare that, you know, you can pull that rubber band so far and it actually, the payoff is actually worth it. Yeah, and just, I think it's really interesting just to get into the mind of that serial killer and have how Mills and him are, like, two, like, flip sides of the coin, aren't they, almost, in terms of what their beliefs and their morals and how much they sort of, you know, get annoyed at each other.
Yeah.
I don't know, I love that scene. I think it's incredible. I think that's a fantastic scene. So that's probably my favourite scene. What would you say yours is?
Having this surprise... attempt at my life that you sprung upon me. Let's say there are a lot of good scenes, but the one that jumps out at me right now is the dinner table scene, because I think that's just a nice character piece, and it's just like these characters getting on.
Yeah, that is a great scene as well.
It's like this calm amongst the storm sort of thing. And it's just, it, like, I think without that moment of elevation, it would, like, the film would lose something. It's the same with the whole library scene bit, but on, like, a much better scale, because this is a good character piece of, like, these three characters getting to know each other and having, trying to find a bit of joy, and then the library bit is one guy reading some books, which, you know, I'm all there for, but this character scene.
No, but again, it's the only sort of like joyous moment, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
In an otherwise just bleak movie.
Exactly. It's the one scene out where all the characters laugh. Like, they're having a good time.
Exactly.
It's great.
Yeah.
Right, we spoke a lot about Janet Maslin's review, so we've actually kind of used up all our time. Do you want to give us your feedback? I mean, you've kind of told us how you feel through this whole
exactly. To add, really? Said that I love this movie.
You love this movie?
Nothing to add other than this is probably my favorite thriller, my favorite Fincher movie, my favorite Morgan Freeman movie. I mean, I could go on. There's quite a lot of favorites that this fits in, so I'm very biased with this one episode. For people out there listening, I think this is a phenomenal film. The cinematography is it's beautiful, it's gorgeous, and I think it's like one of the last times Fincher shot on film as well, I believe. I might be wrong, but it's one of his very few movies that he shot on film anyway, because he now shoots digital. I don't know what more I can say, really. Fantastic film. I mean, I guess the only thing I can add was that Somerset was almost played by Al Pacino, which I think would be a complete different movie. And you wouldn't have got that reserved character at all. You'd have got more of a hoo-ha.
You know, much like, angrier Somerset.
Yes, some more angrier Somerset. Yes, definitely. I love this movie. I think it's incredible. One of the great thrillers, one of the great films of the 1990s. And one of my favourite films probably of all time. So what more of a review can you give than that, Luke? You know? I mean, I didn't really go into detail. I just said it's great.
It was very vague, but like, we're on the plot.
You know, I've gone into detail throughout the entirety of this podcast, so you know.
Exactly.
That's what you get.
I think it's all right. It's a good film.
It's always you, isn't it? You always.
I'm sorry. Right.
So hard to please you, Luke.
It's so hard to. It's one of those. I feel if I'd watched this before, say, like Fight Club, maybe it would be better than Fight Club in my mind, but it's not. It's not at all. I love Fight Club. Fight Club's best film ever. Not best film ever.
It is between those.
Wreck-It Ralph is best between film those ever. Two. But yeah, Fight Club is. I think Fight Club is David Fincher's best film in my opinion. I don't actually know if I like many of David Fincher's films. / I don't know if I've watched many of David Fincher's films, because I know Mank was the Mank Fincher as well.
That was his newest one.
Yeah, I didn't care for that one either. Yeah, it's one of those. I don't know.
That's fantastic.
Maybe I don't like good directors. Well, quote unquote, critically good directors.
Have you seen Social Network?
Yeah, it was great. I like that. I'd say that one was like fractionally lower than this one and Fight Club. I'd say it goes Fight Club, 7, Social Network. But Social Network is like its own entity as well, because it's like a a dramatic documentary-esque film.
Yeah, I think Social Network is like one of the best films of the decade. But that's for another time.
That's for another time when we do Social Network. But yeah, yes. I'd say it was good. It's like it gets a good couple stars. It's not shit by any means. It's not awful, I should say. That's more on brand. But yeah, it's good. I like it. Of the black and white, awful or awesome, it's awesome. But you know, it's all right. It's good. It's good enough.
So is it awful? No, it isn't awful. All right,
nah,
it's
not awful. Is it awesome? Yeah,
it's
I
fantastic.
Guess if those are your only two options, then sure.
No, it is awesome. All right.
Yeah. Brilliant. Right. That's it. That's the show. Where are the socials? Where can people find us?
Right, they can find us on YouTube, where you can watch the visuals, you can watch us, you know, talking with some clips for the cutdowns, or the full-length version where it's just our faces talking, and you can see Luke nodding instead of having him explain it to you on the podcast.
Exactly, and drinking the occasional bit of water.
Exactly. So you can subscribe to that. That'd be fantastic. Click the bell, all that jazz. Give us some likes, please. It'd be brilliant. Please. Give us some comments, you know, please. You know, interact with us. You know, we love this stuff. And, you know, tell us what movies you want to see us do. And any, like, feedback you want to do, give us. Like, we're always open. We really appreciate it. So, yeah, so subscribe to us on YouTube. Follow us on Twitter at @favfilmisawful. You can follow us on Instagram, Your Favourite Film Is Awful, and Facebook, Your Favourite Film Is Awful. You know, one day at the end of these socials, I will be able to say the Twitter handle without messing it up. But at Fav Film Is Awful, F-A-V Film Is Awful. But yeah, that's it, really. Yeah.
That's it. That's the show. We did it. Yay. One in the high back. Five. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.
Bye now. See you later. Bye-bye.
Bye.